Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and we have another podcast recommendation for you. It's Uli Bear's Think About It. On the podcast, Uli interviews all kinds of interesting people about all kinds of interesting things. He has three series that I'd highly recommend, one on free speech, another on great books, and finally, one on affirmative action. You can find Think About It on Apple Podcasts, or you can just go to Uli's website, which is ulrichbaer.com. That's ulrichbaer.com. And you can download or listen to episodes there. We think this is a terrific podcast. In fact, it's so terrific that we're going to offer you a little taste of it. The episode you're about to hear is from Think About It, and I hope you enjoy it.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. No, this is not cabaret, it's Think About It, a podcast about the power of ideas and how language can change the world, with Uli Bear. The British romantic poet William Wordsworth lived from 1770 to 1850. He can be credited with inventing what we consider today autobiography, to talk about ourselves, to think about who we are, and to be deep in our feelings. I spoke with poet Maureen McLean, herself the author of 5 books of poetry and also a critic, about Wordsworth and whether recollecting the past can really give us a feeling as if we are reliving those moments of ecstasy and disappointment yet again. I also want to ask you something, since you are part of the community of people who listen to this show. Think about it. I don't make money off the show. I don't have fancy sponsors. I don't sell you mattresses or makeup or anything else, but you could do me a favor. To be connected to the community, you could review the show on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, or on YouTube. Just click on it, give it a rating, because that makes it easier for other people to find it. And that is my point, to reach more people and to connect more people who care about big ideas, the ideas that shape and sustain our democracy, and who care about and love great books. Thanks for considering doing that. I'd really appreciate it.
So we'll start. So hi, Maureen.
Hi, Uli.
I'm so happy to have you on Think About It today and to talk about Wordsworth.
Glad to be here.
So, you know, I have been rereading Wordsworth, who's known to us as one of the great British romantic poets, one of the poets most school kids are kind of afflicted by, have to read The Daffodils and not incomprehendingly sit there and think, what is this about and why is he such an important figure?
Right.
So I thought I'd read a few lines from one of your poems from this beautiful book, Mrs. N, The Serial. And there's a Wordsworth passage in here. You have a couple of Wordsworth passages, yeah. I think, that are more hidden or tucked away or kind of secreted. And I'll start reading this to you so you'll hear your own words. What? Wordsworth never took a plane. But Miss N takes a plane with Wordsworth on her mind and other matters, love, fear, a wish to die. Wordsworth had a very sturdy mind and legs that took him far into the mountains, Scottish glens, German towns, and yes, across the Alps. Miss N has never seen the Alps nor Snowdon nor a mountain, anywhere beyond the ancient Adirondacks, Wordsworth too, she thinks, would like their worn-down humps, their pathless woods, their rowboats by the shores of placid lakes ready for exploring. Young Wordsworth stole a rowboat, rowed out on a lake one night, and found himself appalled. The mountain strode sublime after him, and he trembled in his mind, as Burke had said it would, before sublimity near failed. There are passages in life, in Wordsworth, he called spots of time. And Miss Anne has some spots she sometimes recollects. But now she's happy, incredulous in love, and in strange anguish, wants to recollect nothing. If it were now to die, 'twere now to be most happy, she murmurs, with the engine nearly exploding, with the fragility and perverse strength of all that lives and moves and has its being in the air, on the ground, in the sea. Having reached a floating state of grace, surprised by joy, she wants to die. Life can only get worse, the mountain receding below them as they climb. So I love this passage for a very specific reason. What I found in this passage is this engagement with Wordsworth, where this idea of spots of time or recollection or going back to a memory of childhood or an experience where you're so filled with the ecstasy of being alive and being part of your surroundings, actually drinking them in, or they're traversing you, that Wordsworth becomes the poet who recollects. And I kind of want to ask you about that. You recollect in the big poems, Tintern Abbey, the Ode, or the Prelude, you recollect and you gain something. There's abundant recompense for recollecting your childhood immediacy. In this poem, you take this turn and you say, but now she's happy, incredulous in love, and in strange anguish wants to recollect nothing. And I thought this is a great way of going into Wordsworth, who proposes to us recollecting can resurrect this memory in us.
As you said, there's a lot of Wordsworth both named in this passage and a lot of Wordsworth thinking about childhood and memory and composition and self-composition, and that has definitely traversed me and has become part of what the logic of my mind. And he's so interesting and significant, certainly in the history of poetries in English, for how much philosophical and poetic time he gave, both to childhood, but also to first impressions and immediacy in general. So that is one aspect of what he honors often in the work. But what's also there always is this second order sense of what comes back to the adult, or what is drawn upon in that moment of these memories or recollections that, as he puts it, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the breath of solitude. So these things that spontaneously come back to us. And, you know, he says somewhere in his preface to Lyrical Ballads, his first, in a way, big book, and he has a line about, he says, well, of course, poetry is a spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. And most people might still think, like, yeah, poetry, you know, I'm moved, right. Poetry is about self-expression, spontaneous overflow, but he does this other thing, and that's the Wordsworthian pivot. He says, yes, poetry is a spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, recollected in tranquility. Right. So there's always that, for him, second beat, which is poetry may present itself to you, a reader, as if it were the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, but from Wordsworth's perspective, it's something that has been composed, recollected, recomposed, written down. He actually often wrote while walking. So it's interesting to think about that, these sort of rhythms of walking and what came back to him. He has an extremely interesting theory of mind and composition and people as almost, you might almost say archaeological or geologic layers, but that would be too static an image, because one almost feels that what happens is we are suddenly shot through with feeling, illumination, memory, image, and these things become, as he says elsewhere, you know, I think life and food for future years. Right. So
they fructify us, or something. Absolutely. He said they nourish.
They nourish us, and whether or not you agree with this, which I think is a highly arguable theory, I would say, it's fascinating in terms of the dignity it gives to childhood experiences, mm-hmm. and it's fascinating in terms of it's being a theory of mind. And how the mind is recursive. They might be 60 and feel themselves just as they were when they were 4, or, you know, and these sort of layers that might suddenly flash upon us and in us. So that's something that I take seriously in Wordsworth. And that the other thing that, or another thing that's really significant about him for me and for many people is that he writes this autobiographical epic. You know, it's probably the first autobiographical epic in verse in English. And it's...
This is the prelude.
It's about himself. It's about his life story.
It goes back to very early, pre-verbal.
Absolutely. Okay. And what it was to be, you know, a small boy in the Lake District in England and, you know, stealing a rowboat and...
But even before that, at his mother's breast, there's this kind of amazing recollection of things that are pre-verbal, maybe pre-symbolic. And when you say it's one of the first autobiographical epics, in some ways, how does this happen that someone could start thinking about himself in this way as material for poetry? And until then, what had people written about?
I mean, it is. I was thinking about it walking over here. There's a way in which he's such a kind of official institutional poet, particularly in Britain, but probably in the U.S., he still shows up in syllabi. And, and even if people don't read Wordsworth, they've heard of Wordsworth. And one of the things, I mean, he definitely has an incredibly boring, serious aura. His own contemporaries said that about him, too. I think that's part of the, as it were, problem of Wordsworth.
Right.
But what's amazing is that for all of his high seriousness, he's also a poet of joy.
But that's what I kind of find interesting. You said he's serious. He is an institution because he is the first poet to do something for us, which is, for us, meaning he gives us ourselves as material for reflection. And reflection to cover everything we've become, to go back to who we were, to know who we are today, and reflecting. So this epic unfolds as the story of his mind and of his life.
Which is a deeply, deeply weird project in 1800.
You know, right.
For us now, I mean, if most people think
that's
about...
all we do, actually.
Right.
That's
if most people now think of, if you say to somebody you're a poet, they assume that you're writing about your personal experience.
I actually think when people say, who are you? They say, where'd you grow up? Who are your parents? What you do,
what do you
remember, what you do in New York and where do you live, that's
exactly.
New York. But actually that we make sense of ourselves comprehensively, reaching back into childhood, saying, I had this experience, therefore I am that today. This has become the mode of how we think about ourselves.
And it's probably no accident that, say, post-psychoanalysis, somebody like Wordsworth, I mean, that turn to the child and the family and these significant early events, that the way they might resonate throughout one's life, he becomes an ongoing kind of resource.
A kind of commonplace around 1800 that people thought your childhood experience may determine how you behave today?
And also there was just a much stronger class determination, particularly in Britain. I mean, the sense that you would dilate hundreds and hundreds of lines, thousands of lines on childhood experience would seem self-indulgent and ludicrous. And it's not an accident that Wordsworth did not publish the prelude in his lifetime. It's a posthumous thing. And what he was most famous in his lifetime for poems like his poems, Lyrical Ballads, these short lyrics, which are often extremely beautiful, but there are also a number of poems that are about social life and meeting peasants on the road or meeting old rustics. And that part of Wordsworth gets forgotten because people tend to think of Wordsworth as the poet of what Keats said, the egotistical sublime. He's Mr. Ego, you know. And in the U.S., we have Whitman, who's our Mr. Ego. So it's an interesting comparison. But to think of, the originality of the task Wordsworth set himself, you know, he, throughout this poem, The Prelude, that comes to be known as The Prelude, he's modeling himself on Milton. And if you think Milton wrote an epic on, you know, to justify the ways of God to man, this is a striking, peculiar, and deeply modern turn, right? This sort of inward turn that Wordsworth is part of. And in a certain key, you see this with some of his contemporaries. I mean, Byron writes long poems. But that sense of really taking personal experience seriously and philosophically, and also that whatever the specifics of your experience are, they could be generalized. You could say, as some contemporaries did, he was a crazily self-absorbed person, and how can you devote a poetry to this? You could also say that he understood his childhood as allegorical material that anybody would have an analogous childhood and could think about their lives in a certain way.
And when you said earlier, he starts in feeling, which I found really interesting. That sort of actually originates in feeling. It goes to this other part, you said, in Lyrical Ballads, where he's very connected to other people. And a lot of it is how to connect with other people, sort of how to hear this still sad song of humanity. There's this other part. The other part, but at the same time, the Wordsworth we've received is a somewhat staid and formal person.
Hyper-regulated.
Which he isn't, actually, once you read it. He actually isn't. It's like most poets who become canonized, they're sort of put into a space and they say they do something
for the... Right, they become a monument.
Yeah. as if the tradition really just absorbs them in a kind of, they put in a box and there they are. But yes, the feeling part is really interesting, that you said his childhood can become a model for other people how to think about their childhood. Right. But it's not, they're not going to have the same experiences.
Right.
They're not going to have the same feelings. But how to even make sense of a feeling you once had and you're looking back at it, which is what I like this in your poem here in this book, that you kind of set this up and you're kind of rowing with Wordsworth out into the lake and there's a kind of sublimity and there are passages in life. And then you say, but now she's happy, incredulous in love. And I like something in this line, she's happy, incredulous in love. There's no line break because the happiness is something she can't understand. There's an incredulity about happiness, about feeling, which I think Wordsworth keeps on bringing us back to a feeling and says, this is the feeling I was in.
Yeah.
Now I can look back at it. And it's not progress. It's not chronology. It's not psychoanalysis, which tries to unlock the mysteries of childhood and say,
right,
this is the key to us.
Right.
It says, there's that feeling. This is what I felt. Here I am now. So psychoanalysis will do something very different,
yes,
with childhood memories,
yes,
which are mostly locked in some kind of...
Right, and there's almost, as it were, the kind of, you know, detective,
yeah,
you know, novel logic. You know, Wordsworth is up to something else. You know, his sense, too, that poetry in any art begins in the sensations of the body and the feelings of the body. And he's, by reputation, he's the least sexy of poets, right? He's the most...
He's not Shelley.
He's not Byron. He's not Keats. You know, no one's going to go make a biopic. I mean, it would be interesting to see a biopic of
Shelley,
you know.
Right.
Yeah, so he doesn't... And
so Coleridge is incredibly charismatic.
Exactly. Yeah.
Coleridge. What's Keats' attraction for the world?
Well, I mean, he's young, and he writes these beautiful winning letters, and you just feel the force of this unbelievably lovely, funny, smart, brilliant young man making himself in language and in friendship.
Right.
And you know, Wordsworth has a different sensibility. And in a way, one often wants to read Wordsworth against Wordsworth, Wordsworth against his reception, because the reception is so like, oh my God, Wordsworth. And the fact is, that's partly a deserved reputation, but I also think there are just extraordinary passages, particularly in the first 10 years of his publishing life, between, say, 1797 and 1807, people talk about the miraculous decade, when he really kind of came into his own. The story of Wordsworth is so much a story of kindling friendship. He meets Coleridge, they're, you know, literally exchanging stanzas,
right,
composing together as they're walking through, you know, the hills, and also with Dorothy.
Right.
You know, so there's this community, this powerful young community of young radicals who are sympathetic to the recently disastrously concluded French Revolution.
But this is an important aspect in the prelude. The revolution, which is the hope
Absolutely.
Of Europe,
exactly,
they are in favor of it, then their hopes are dashed, but they somehow carry on.
And Wordsworth is a little, you know, he's a tricky one politically, depending on what your persuasions are. I mean, he has two books in the prelude devoted to what he calls residence in France. He's over in France,
right,
you know, and he hears about, you know, the death of Robespierre, and he's being taken around, actually by a royalist officer, and is going there as a young Englishman who felt the brotherhood of man. And he was completely endorsing, you know, fraternité, liberté, égalité. These were the virtues he, too, was espousing as a young man. Now, he came to have a much more cautious relation to radicalism. So in a way, Wordsworth becomes this, for a lot of readers who go deep into Wordsworth, he becomes a kind of figure of disappointing liberalism. He becomes a figure sort of avant la lettre of a kind of neoconservative turn. You know, Shelley called him a turncoat. You know, he becomes a figure for his own younger contemporaries.
And
Shelley dies very young.
Knowledge what Shelley would have.
Exactly. I mean, Shelley, I think, is 29.
Of course,
right,
there's a great romance in anybody who was about
who dies young. Exactly.
But there's something, you know, as you said, there's a kind of physical dimension in Wordsworth, which has to be glossed over for this story to really work.
Yes.
It's very interesting. It's very physical. Even and all of his memories are usually physical. He retrieves them.
Right. He's rowing a boat. You get many, many passages of walking. As you said, you get this fascinating image of the babe suckling. He's also a really interesting open-air poet. There's a lot of, you know, I mean, the prelude begins, oh, there is blessing in this gentle breeze, right?
Right.
So this idea, that it's a poetry of the outdoors. And there's a reason why he has been significant for people who are interested in environmental readings and ecological readings of Romanticism, both because of the richness of the work and because of 200 plus years of reception. You know, if I'm talking about him with students or with friends or with myself, I kind of want to reactivate the feeling sensing Wordsworth.
But I felt like what you activated in this one passage, which is an obvious one because it mentions Wordsworth never took a plane, what you wanted to activate is this duality, it's tension, but productive tension, that there is, we want to be in the moment, and we also look back at every moment. And of course, all poetry is always, it always tries to grasp the moment, but Wordsworth has a way of doing that without this kind of melancholic loss. We once lived fully, but now I look back at this and I'm no longer young. Or the kind of ecstatic, I'm going to lose myself to the moment and try to recreate it in the poem and end up giving you what Jeffrey Hartman, one of my teachers, called a kind of false immediacy.
Yes.
And so he's constantly dealing with mediation that I can't get to my own experience, of course, because the mind intervenes and language intervenes, but it's not a problem in a way. So I thought you activated this part to say, there's tension, but this tension can be opened up rather than we have to resolve it for either the past ecstatic memory, I mean, the experience and today's memory of it.
I think that is just really astute. And I think that is the kind of thing that he dramatizes again and again in some of the big famous poems, like the Ode Intimations on Immortality, where that sense of the joys of childhood, they may have fallen away partly through education, partly through just the accretion of experience. But he transforms that. It isn't this sort of tragedy, melancholy of adulthood. It is a higher order pleasure. He wants to give it to us as a simultaneity.
This was my big question reading this week. So in the Intimations Ode, in Tintern Abbey, there's a first pass, they're different, so the structures are different. So in the Ode, there's four stanzas where he is this child, everything was given to him.
Right.
He was able to experience the world. And then he didn't write the next part for quite a long time, right? There's a couple of years break, and then the next part, like, we are kind of asleep to the world in this kind of platonic way. We're in a cave. We'll never get access to the world again. And this is what I was trying to figure out, and that's what I really wanted to ask you. Is that satisfying to say there is this abundant recompense in older age where we look back at our childhood or our youthful kind of ecstasies? Because there seems to be some openness to this. In Tintern Abbey also, he says, I look back on this, I was here 5 years ago, now I look again at the banks of the Wye, and it sort of gives me what I couldn't have gotten because now my mind has grown and matured.
I mean, you know, do I think Wordsworth's sense of compensations is satisfying? Not 100%. Do I think that he is a kind of genius of dramatizing the movements of self and mind and time, and that sense, the Intimations Ode begins, there was a time when the earth and every common scene to me did seem appareled in celestial light, the vision and the glory of a dream. I'm kind of dragging various phrases. So you get this vision, and then he says, it is not now as it hath been of yore. So there, the thing I'm really interested in him too is the way his poems hold time. You know, so it's a sort of like self-diagnostic moment. There was a time, it is not now as it hath been of yore. The pansy at my feet doth the same tale repeat. Whither has it been? You know, the glory and the dream. Where is it now? The glory and the dream. And that sense of disappointed hopes, things that have come crashing down upon you in adulthood, whether you understand that as failures of relationships, the failures of the French Revolution. And then he does this move, and how one thinks about this move probably has to do with our own temperaments. He, as you said, he put aside the poem after the initial four stanzas where he got to this crux, whither has gone the glory and the dream, whether has gone all of those upsurges of joy and that capacity for rich and positive feeling, it sits for a couple of years. And when he returns to this more general myth of our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The idea of, you know, all of us pre-exist our birth and come into the world. And in a way, this is where you could see is a kind of exactly, and that in, there's a kind of fascinating way in which the baby itself is coming with all of this capacity for the new, with all of this, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's secularizing a lot of Christian aura, but that sense of this myth, right? That kind of blissful holiness that babies are born with, it starts to dim, and yet we still have access to it when we hear the mighty waters of the sea, when we suddenly, you know, come upon a field, maybe For some of us, it would be when we saw an astonishing skyscraper, right? What would it be that would kind of reconnect us with this imminence?
Well, in your poem, it's very clear.
Yeah.
You say no. You don't say there's a, but now she's happy, incredulous, in love. You're not seeing a skyscraper, I think.
Right.
In this poem, it's love. It's another person. Right. It's actually what's interesting, what you said earlier, when Wordsworth connects with people.
Yes.
There is something there. So the question of, is there enough recompense? So he says in this ode, O joy that in our embers is something that doth live. Something in us, as it were, knows more than what we know when we mature and gain knowledge. And
that's a wonderful and, you know, very Wordsworthian formulation.
But it's unclear that we know more because it's in our embers and we have to kindle it. And the poem kind of kindles it or fans this flame.
Yeah.
It's in our embers. It's not a flame, really. And I read what you described earlier in the first four stanzas, and then Our Birth is but a Slumber, that it's also a story of what the Enlightenment gives us.
Yes.
Whether knowledge will actually liberate us and make us free, which is Freud's big question about civilization. He said, we end up less happy. How strange is that? And actually, Wordsworth doesn't settle there, he says. Actually, what we learn that something in us can be activated, this capacity, and there's this enormous capacity in him when the poems that go from this younger to older age. In older age, he has this amazing capacity for joy.
He does this interesting thing, this sort of transvaluation of what you might have thought was a disappointment. So towards the end of the Intimations Ode, he says, you know, not for these early wonderful things do I raise thoughts, you know, thanksgiving and praise, but for those blank misgivings, for all the obstacles that we face as sentient beings when we are adults. I want to praise those things, he says. Now, whether I think that's the way to go. You know, I mean, obviously, I think there's a kind of power. Well, to go back to your earlier question, I think that the category of happiness isn't one that necessarily resonates with him as much. He does write a lot about pleasure. But when Wordsworth writes about pleasure, it often doesn't sound so much like pleasure. But he also does talk about, quote, a wise passiveness and a kind of wisdom. So again, I think that, you know, Wordsworth is carrying some heavy water or doing some heavy lifting on behalf of the complexity of human development and wanting to keep alive, as you said, a duality or a productive tension between immediacy and overwhelming force of passions, whether they be sexual passions or anger or joy or,
political passions, absolutely. Passions.
Which he, as you said, he's already disillusioned and he still writes about a revolution as the greatest moment that, but he already knows it's not going to work out the way he wanted it to work out.
So he does this very interesting thing where he never fully disavows and yet he slightly contains. And it's an interesting way to think about also meter, that it's meter as a measuring,
right.
You know, and that there's a fascinating way in which there is this both and quality all the time with Wordsworth, both in terms of what the content of the poems, but also the actual form of the poems,
right.
You know. So I think he's very interesting to think with because he keeps alive a complexity that often, you know, either say psychoanalysis might pathologize certain things or want us, his notion of being disabused is different, I believe, from a notion of a psychoanalytic notion of being disabused.
What's the notion of being disabused in psychoanalysis?
That knowledge isn't actually, you know, not an unproblematic liberation,
right?
I mean, the future of an illusion,
right?
You know, the Enlightenment, you know, creates its own structures of illusion.
Right.
And I do think there's something incredibly moving if you read, say, Wordsworth's essays on epitaphs.
Yeah.
I mean, people really struggling to think about the afterlife, really struggling to think about the relationship among generations, really trying to think about futurity. I also think, and this is something that can kind of fall by the boards, but Wordsworth is committed, at least in theory, to the notion of a poetry of, quote, common life, and a poetry in common language. He writes powerfully against poetic diction, against highfalutin, you know, language. And so while he might sound, to contemporary American ears, for example, formal and a little stuffy, he actually is writing what in that period would have been a kind of regularized literary standard English, a kind of common idiom.
So what would he sound like in American English today?
I mean, it's an interesting thing because I actually think there's an argument to be made about Wordsworth to Whitman, not in the sense of influence, but in the sense of if democratic modernity means art should be able to carry the experiences and the hopes and the common language of a community, then I think there's something you know, Wordsworth doesn't always do it, but that's what he says poetry should be doing. You know, because he has this idea of the poet as both special and typical. So he says the work of poetry is a man speaking to men. It's not a higher inspired Vedic. He's like, the poet is a man speaking to men.
So it's not the Vedic role of the prophetic.
Even though you do get scenes of that in his work, but it's a really powerful democratic gauntlet he throws down, that a poet is a man speaking. Of course, it's hyper-gendered, right? A man speaking to men. But if you polemically universalize that, I think, you know, there's a lot in common with a Whitmanian, I celebrate myself and sing myself and what I assume you shall assume, and that reciprocity. Now, Wordsworth goes on to say, too, that the poet is like any other person. We have the same bodies, the same sensoria, but the poet has a more than usual organic sensibility. So he wants to say the poet is both like everyone else and yet has slightly more vibrating nerve endings.
When you bring up Whitman, I want to ask you something. So Whitman also sings America into existence as this kind of polyglot, multi-vocal, diverse place, to a point, right? Wordsworth is both a very, very British poet, but at the same time,
he does talk a lot about Britain and Britannia.
Okay, so English. But what you just described is actually that he's opening up poetry to a more general humanity,
100%.
Because it's not classed, because he looks at beggars and vagrants. Yeah. In book 7 of the Prelude, he's in the city. It's this overwhelming canvas of humanity. Really interestingly, super global and diverse. It's actually like one of Rilke's elegies where he goes to the circus and there's all the attractions and it's kind of a circus. But this idea that he's opening up to a more generalized humanity versus to an English humanity. Because I wonder whether he's, because, you know, American school kids have to read Daffodils, and not only Americans. People in Jamaica, people in India.
Oh, exactly.
And I've always talked to people.
Something with a Jamaica Kincaid.
Absolutely.
Which talking about, basically, what the fuck is a daffodil?
The daffodils,
you know,
or the winter, like,
you know, we don't
knock
have winter
the last
in Jamaica.
Autumnal,
these are not flowers of our climate.
The last autumnal crocus down, and I thought, oh, it must become winter now because there's some type of crocus that blooms in the fall. So she said, I was taught, and I knew more about the daffodils than any British kid, but I wasn't in England. So the climate didn't quite work. So is it a more universal, general humanity he's talking to, or is it the one that you want to stay in Cambridge and book? Is it book 2 of the Prelude?
Exactly. You know? Right.
I would maybe slightly reformulate the question, which is what he says poetry should do, or his hopes for poetry is that it might be universalizable, or, you know, to, as he says elsewhere, to extend the domain of human sympathy, right? And that so he talks a lot about, you know, humans and common life. In actuality, of course, he's drawing on a very particular national, classed, hierarchized landscape and experience. I think that is a diagnostic tension. I think that tells us a lot more about the complexities of modernity than it does about whether Wordsworth should be kind of thrown off the bus or not.
Well, I'm also interested when you said there's the specific and then the general.
Yeah.
Would there be any poetry that is not rooted in the particularity of the speaking subject?
Right.
Because Wordsworth gives us poetry about himself, right?
So those ratios would be, I would say, different in a poet who traffics more in abstraction. Yeah. I mean, again, there's never not going to be that oscillation. But if one thinks about somebody, say, like Wallace Stevens or Fernando, you know, Pessoa, or this is another interesting aspect about Wordsworth, that he says the language of poetry should be no different from the language of prose. Mm-hmm. And that sense that the long poem, the prelude, the long autobiographical epic, it's full of narrative and stories.
Right.
And it shares a lot of commitments with a realist novel. I was walking down this path. I was in Paris at this time. I heard the death of Robespierre. I mean, you can date, you can place. There are real correlates. Whereas, and Whitman, again, also has social location and some specific correlates. But Wordsworth has a lot, in the Prelude, he has a lot of specific sites and locales, although they do get quite generalized in some of the odes, you know, the supposedly higher genres. So in the Immortality Ode, you know, he says, there was a tree of many one, a field that I have looked upon. Both speak to me of something that is gone. Where's that tree? Where's that field? You know, he doesn't say there was an oak tree in Windermere. So it's a very interesting thing about what feels hyper-specific and what feels more generalized, that sense of how Wordsworth travels or doesn't, and also how he was made to travel as part of an imperial curriculum is fascinating.
But even what you just said, the line, there was a tree of many one, quintessential outrageous gesture of poetry to posit something in the mind and say, there was a tree of many one, there was a field.
Tall tree in the ear.
Yeah, a tall tree in the ear is Rilke. It's also the tree of knowledge. It's the tree as a symbol of creation, of growth, of the human form. So all of these, there's a kind of symbolism behind it, but there's also not a symbolism that there's a tree, you're seeing it now.
Exactly.
And this is going to be the specific tree in my poem. I'm going to do something with it. So it sort of becomes a stand-in figure for, is it a specific tree?
Right.
Of course it's specific,
right,
because it's the one he remembers.
Right.
And we all know what that means. We all have something we remember. It's specific
exactly.
to me. Part of what I'm going to try to do is to explain to you what that tree meant to me. And I'm not going to explain to you what that tree was.
Right.
So actually, it stood on this corner in this or in that forest or in this garden or in this something. That's not so relevant. But say that tree was so meaningful to me.
Exactly.
So he teaches us that certain things become very relevant on a human level because they're so specific to one person. Because we invest things with meaning rather than they have a meaning because it stood on that corner, stood in that village.
I mean, that's such a good example of what he glosses in the Tintern poem, where he talks about things that we both...
It's a very long time.
You know, lines composed a few miles above Tintern Abbey. It gets shortened as...
And revisiting the banks of the Wye during a tour July 13th, 1798, which I had to look up because everybody calls it Tintern.
He had a lot of long titles. And he has some notion there. He talks about things, both what we half perceive and half create, and that's another aspect of thinking about how the mind works and how we make meaning for ourselves, and also how it becomes shareable with others.
But this part is very, Tintern Abbey is like as if someone is telling you something. What's weird about it, it's his mind and him revisiting a place he's been to 5 years ago, but when I reread all the poems, I thought someone is really trying to speak with someone else. They're actually strangely about himself and his own mind in this conversation, but as if he's trying to share and impart with you, which is unusual because there are lots of poets. I mean, Wallace Stevens, as you said, abstract, you're not quite sure if Wallace Stevens is speaking to you or not.
Right.
He's speaking to, I don't quite know, but he, you know, he's also speaking to you.
I mean, it makes me think, too, of the line of Yeats, you know, that poetry is the argument with oneself, whereas rhetoric is the argument with others. And I think... A really interesting thing with Wordsworth is that often, and as you say, when he is speaking, as it were, in propria persona and saying things about that we take as autobiographical about his own experience, he will also do this thing where he will turn to somebody else. And so, for example, in the prelude, the long story, it was also subtitled The Growth of a Poet's Mind. So the idea, too, that autobiography isn't event, event, event.
The titling wasn't so good.
No.
He needed a better marketer. It's not bad.
But he does, he has all of these, tales and apostrophes to the clouds and to the breeze.
Right.
But then he will turn and he'll say, you know, thus I used to pour out my heart to you, O friend. And this poem was also known as the poem to Coleridge.
Right.
So he will turn in the middle of a passage and turn to Coleridge and address Coleridge directly. He also does this in shorter poems.
When that happens,
I think it one thing it does is it super wakes you up as a reader, and
right.
you realize
right.
that it also creates an implicit drama, right? A drama of either a mobile mind. I mean, I don't know about you, but if I'm walking around, I mean, you know, there's always that stream of whatever's going on in your head and
right.
whatever you're hearing, and then you might think of a friend or you might think of a parent or a child, and it sort of notes to them, and he builds that into the poem, and he does this amazing thing in Tintern where you get all of his own feelings about returning to a place 5 years later and the change in his perception. Then he suddenly turns to his sister. And,
right.
you know, and,
right.
and you know, you, younger than I, are now in the first flush of all of your feelings. And so you are to me a second self, he says, you know, carrying and experiencing what I did, you know, at an earlier point of my life. And it's a very interesting move. He does a similar thing in lyrical ballads where he will include conversation. The poem, part of the matter of the poem is staged as a conversation with an old huntsman or an old man going to the seashore. Or so I think the fact that the poems as social encounters often drops out in accounts of Wordsworth. Often people think that he's a poet of nature, he's a poet of childhood, he's out there addressing trees and birds. Right. And it's like, that's not false, but he's also always out on the so-called public way. Right. He's always presenting himself as if, you know, as walking on various roads, meeting vagrants, meeting people of other class positions. Now, this doesn't mean he's, some radical Democrat proto-communist at all, but it does mean that he's interested in making poems out of complex social encounters. And one of the things I really like, or I feel like I've learned in thinking and reading, thinking about and reading Wordsworth, is that sense that inner and outer are permeable. It's not like there are poems of consciousness and poems of social encounter. They are in the same space for Wordsworth. And I think too often that gets amputated in our senses of literature and of poetry.
I remember reading the first lines of Tintern Abbey in a class with Jeffrey Hartman, actually, which is a nice way to remember him by. And I showed you, I have all those little notes there. And so the first few lines, which, and he taught me something there about poetry, what you just said, it opens up something with other people. It also opens up time. So the first lines are, 5 years have passed, 5 summers with the length of 5 long winters. And Hartman said, look, it's 5 years have passed. We know that means 5 summers and 5 winters, but the line opens up space and time for us. By saying 5 years have passed, 5 summers with the length of 5 long winters opens up the space of 5 long winters, as if we're now entering into time opening up. And Hartman said, this is what the poem can do. It opens up time. Yes. And it's not looking back at this lost moment. He said, 5 years have passed. And then he says, 5 summers with the length of 5 long winters, obviously. But there's nothing obvious that time can be opened up by us.
And the subjectivity of our perception of time. I mean, the incredible weirdness of the opening. I mean, the fact is, the poem is always present. 5 years have passed. Right now, 5 years have passed.
Right.
When you were reading with Jeffrey Hartman, right then, 5 years. So the time of the poem is imminent, right? So we're plunged into it. 5 years have passed. With a, 5 summers with the length of 5 long winters.
And then that is a weird way that the poem keeps going.
And then he says, and again I hear. And you're sort of thinking, wait, where are we now? 5 years have passed from when? Again, something happening. I hear in the present.
Right now.
So he's opening up.
Exactly.
And what you said, we don't live in the present all the time. Actually, I think Wordsworth does in a good way. We're not melancholic and mournful for the past. But of course, what we're doing right now also makes us recollect, or it echoes certain things in the past. And that deepens it rather than weakens it. There's a sense in which my original question was, is there a loss because he doesn't have what his sister now has, this immediacy, the first time there,
I think the poems acknowledge the loss. I think there is I think the poems are partly feeling out the loss and also feeling out, he's a great poet of adverbs, and so you get a lot of the yet and the still, and it's like, what remains to me yet, even though those first glorious, unconscious attunements with nature and with pleasure have fallen away, what remains to me yet? And so I think that the poems hold the complexity.
There's also a part where he just said unconscious attunements. I thought, well, that's a lot of syllables. No, in a good way. And I thought, but a lot of it is also him recollecting all these terrible things he did, all these things.
It's
and
true.
He sort of went kind of wild. He was kind of a wild kid.
Yeah.
And there's something about the kind of violence or this kind of ruthlessness he had. So in some ways, he wasn't just attuned with nature, looking at how beautiful everything. He was very much of a boy's boy.
Oh, yeah, and that whole thing about the kind of... going hunting, stealing
and raiding
the
nests.
Raiding nests.
Nests and like birds. And he sort of cheats basically in other people's traps. And then he steals a boat. And then he goes nutting and he ravages this tree for no reason. He said, I had enough nuts for the last lifetime and I kept on just going. So there's a kind of weird openings to nature where he says it could also become really uncontrollable.
Yes.
So ecstatic doesn't just mean he's a nature poet the way he walks along the curated landscape.
No, this isn't like New Age.
No.
This isn't a kind of...
This isn't a walking tour of the Lake District.
No, this is not an...
And that wildness gets lost, I think, in Wordsworth. And,
no, he gets pacified. I mean, he partly self-pacified, but he gets pacified in reception, and it'll be, you know, like nice little pastoral scenes with birds. And actually, he has, you know, figurations of, you know, violating plants, like super sexually violent images.
Right.
And he does want to think hard about, you know, what now some people would call negative affect, right? He wants to think hard about desire and lawlessness, and yet there's still a sense of possible harmonies with the cosmos that I think keeps it under control in a way for him. I don't think this is a poet who fully goes down the full route of the possible nihilism of desire at all. I think that was held elsewhere in the blankness of possible mountain faces, the problems of divinity. You know, I don't think that he found that. I mean, I think that's a kind of Satanism. What in that period they would have possibly called it. That was something that, say, Byron was much more alert to. I mean, there is a question of, is Wordsworth actually alert to the problem of evil?
I mean, it's interesting that you say that he's not open to the nihilism of desire. In both of your books, the three books, This Blue and then and the serial, you talk quite a bit of being on the edge of something. That's a very funny poem, actually, that I won't read right now. It's a very sexual poem. It's very funny, I think, and you're sort of on the edge, and you're like, I didn't know what was beyond it. So, yeah, I was on the edge, but I didn't know what an orgasm was, something. It's a very funny poem because you say, but the nihilism of desire would be not memorable. We wouldn't know it even. We'd fall into it, as it were, sort of.
Right.
We would drop into it and we would be completely engulfed in this ecstatic experience and we wouldn't come back out with a memory of it. It would be traumatic in psychoanalytic terms.
Right.
So we wouldn't know. So you're saying, yeah, I'm on the edge, but I don't even know. I'm just going to say yes because probably, but if I were on the edge, I would no longer be on the edge. I would have fallen in.
Right.
Which is actually what Wordsworth, what you're saying, he probably doesn't have that, but it's there. As a,
it's definitely there.
Because nature is also not a tamed or benevolent. It's actually not what we want it to be, which is this great life-giving force.
He writes really interestingly about fear, too, and being afraid, and he has a sense of the sublime as something that is about forces which annihilate our minds, too. And I think he's really good on that, you know? And so it's not all about cheerful consciousness at all.
There's a passage... a stanza in your book, This Blue, which I heard something in Wordsworth in there, you say, what I'm looking for is a golden bowl, carefully repaired, a complete world sealed along cracked lines. And there's something because in the prelude, he says, our mind are nourished and invisibly repaired by this possibility of recollecting these intense feelings or emotions and tranquility. And sort of when you said, I'm looking for a golden bowl, a complete world sealed along cracked lines, that the world is not perfect, whole, but you want to have it whole along cracked lines, knowing that there are gaps, ruptures, blanks, etc. But knowing that would actually be a kind of solace or something. And for Wordsworth too, he says, our minds are nourished and invisibly repaired.
He has a much greater faith in this invisible reparation. I think that if elements of that appear in my work, it appears in the optative mode. It's something one is looking for.
I'm giving you the stanza in the middle of a poem. So there's another one after that.
It's about a thing one might look for and hope for, but one does not assume. Whereas there's a lot of, especially in middle and older Wordsworth, where he asserts what in fact is in question. You know, so the hymns to the healed mind, it's like maybe yes, maybe no. You know, I on that I'm agnostic. You know, what I find in a way really moving about Wordsworth is the really serious effort to grapple with it, the really serious effort to grapple with broken minds and broken bonds, failed hopes. So I like him when he's more in his struggling modality than when he's in his affirmative modality. I'm going to be happier with people who can tolerate
negation and negativity but I do think there's something really just powerful and moving about how he really did try to encompass the kind of fault lines in ourselves and the fault lines between people and between what one might hope and what the world makes possible. That is often something he's specifically addressing in the poetry. Now, does he prematurely rush in to have things be repaired or healable? Does he later on in his life write odes to duty? Yes, he does. You know, I mean, he can be a real downer. You know,
but maybe it comes out of the awareness that it isn't given. In some ways, to say when you're saying some of it, he wants it. He wants to believe in the repairability.
Yes,
we all do.
Of course,
I think we all do.
Yeah.
Is he taking a shortcut? Probably not. And this is actually, I think, what you just said. There are false hopes. The question is, is there? It would be probably insincere or ring kind of untrue or inauthentic if it was a shortcut. But he's doing the work to say, well, how would we get there?
Yeah.
So I think this is the what is actually moving about Wordsworth. He takes it seriously, and if he took a shortcut somewhere and say, oh, and then I could gather myself and look at my memory, and now I'm in the present, and this is all. He said, no, there are fault lines, and what I'm trying to do is really be very attentive to these fault lines. And it's, I think also how I hear your question is sort of saying, do they make us deeper? Do they make us better? They're just what we experience. It's not totally given. It's sort of a Blakean question. Does experience make us more profound than innocence? I don't know.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I don't think he gives you that answer, that the fault lines, the cracks in the wall are something we want to really forget and gloss over.
Or, I don't think he does at all.
No, we can't.
Yeah,
all the poems open up.
Exactly.
I mean, that is, you know, the material of a lot of the work, particularly in the prelude. I mean, we're pivoting among a bunch of different areas, but yeah.
But it seems to be this is a central concern of his, say, other poems, as you said, where he maybe, and I wouldn't call them shortcuts, where maybe he's trying to do something else.
He really wanted to write, or he had this whole plan of writing, the great philosophic poem. He was going to write The Recluse. And it's interesting because he never quite delivered on The Recluse, and what he's most known for at this point probably are a number of the shorter poems that are astonishing and lodge in your ear, and these strange Lucy poems, these sort of supernatural poems, and then some of the lyrical ballads, some of which showed up in school books and schoolrooms, and then the prelude as this very long autobiographical epic. And one of the antechamber to The Recluse was this poem he published in 1814 called The Excursion, and it famously got this review that began, "This will never do.
This will never do." And, you know,
that's what one of his contemporaries said.
Yeah, that's what Francis Jeffrey, this kind of fabulously cranky.
This will never do.
This will never do. So.
Who is named, let's just say that we do not remember, but we do remember Wordsworth.
Yes.
Just sort of for some poetic justice that actually this reviewer, what was his name, who said this will never do, is largely forgotten outside of academia.
Yeah. But it is a good line, right?
You know? Yeah.
If not, maybe.
It's a good line, yes.
So,
And what did he see as a problem with that poem?
I think, you know, he and many others, they thought it was ponderous and labored and didn't take wing, and that things got so burdened with what Wordsworth wanted philosophically to deliver, that that part of him that was didactic started displacing other slightly brightening elements. So I think that they just one of the things that's kind of fascinating about Wordsworth too is how much he courted the ludicrous. You know, he was willing to, and a lot of, because he wrote these poems and lyrical ballads, a poem like, say, for example, The Idiot Boy, or, these various poems. And other critics of his milieu and class were saying, this is actually idiotic and it's a form of slumming, and why are you writing about, these sort of low customers? It's a completely bogus move. This is not their diction, but it's mine. And so it's very interesting. He activated other people's resistance because he wanted to have these poems of social cross-class social encounter. And he also, his whole theory of poetic diction and that there should be a common language, Coleridge later on took him to task and said, look, Wordsworth is best when he's writing in his own voice. We don't want to hear Wordsworth, you know, all of his, you know, all of his claims about writing in the selection of the language of rustics, i.e., you know, peasants or farm laborers, working class people. This is a really weird thing that Coleridge says. This is a really odd theory that, in fact, is inaccurate to Wordsworth's own practice. And, you know, who cares about rustic language? Let's just do it in Wordsworth. You know, so he raised a lot of hackles in both some of his poems, and then he became, of course, this Victorian monument, and he was endlessly editing his own works. He took a government position as the distributor of stamps in Wexmoreland.
He's like the Goethe of England, takes a government position, who endlessly edits his works, and who raised a lot of hackles with different things, and at the same time, is assigned if poor school children are afflicted with reading it. What's today when you hear that kind of English, though, it's incredibly accessible. And so he did something to the English language that actually opened it up, probably in a way that high poetry could speak in this way.
I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, So one of the lyrics, I wandered lonely as a cloud. And now that's not a thing you're probably going to hear, you know, walking down the Bowery. But that is, he has a number of poems where it's not like you feel like you're teaching in translation, where often things from 1800 can feel like you are teaching. And of course, you are teaching in different kinds of cultural translation. But the fact that he got taken up in schooling, and there, it's interesting to think of other poets in the period who were writing in this middle register of standard English, and so he, you know, he's not the only one, but at all. But if you think the great poem by Thomas Gray, the ode, the churchyard, the elegy in a country churchyard, and it begins, the curfew tolls the knell of parting day. Now, that's probably a pretty esoteric line for us. We don't have a curfew bell tolling the knell of parting day. But it goes on in what for the period was a fairly general accessible zone of a newly standardized English. Some of his other poems were much more ornate, with a much more elaborate diction, and they would have personifications marching along, and they would seem instantaneously hyper-literary and dated. Okay. And so some of Wordsworth still hits, some of Whitman can still hit a bandwidth of English, even though it'll still seem a little, but the idea that one would write out of a potentially common idiom, that, I mean, you know, you could argue that people are writing Wordsworth all their lives and not knowing it, right? Theoretically, if not, there's a strong argument to be made, a counter argument, which is the kind of false tyranny of accessibility. It's like, so why should poetry be written in common language?
False tyranny of accessibility.
Yeah,
because accessibility also means a certain kind of value or standard, and it sort of imposes that on.
I mean, some people might want a poetry that is filled with, you know, weirdness and surreality and strange sonic effects, and so somebody like Wallace Stevens can be filled with all this jingle jangle, right? It's like, what is he saying? Whereas if, you know, a lot of US poetry is written in a kind of shared language as the realist novel.
I also think it's interesting when you said the false tyranny of accessibility, that maybe a political concern, sociological concern. There's another issue when Wordsworth talks about having very deep experiences and then trying to assess what the meaning of those experiences is later, because they don't have an inherent meaning in some ways. Sometimes actually the reflection upon them allows him to say, what was the meaning of this to me? It's not the meaning came, sort of, it came ready-made with its meaning.
Right.
It's dynamic.
It's dynamic. Created.
And by looking at 5 years ago, I was this person, now I'm that person, that is actually part of what the meaning is. It isn't just the meaning was there, now I can grab it. That maybe I don't want a very deeply felt experience to be rendered in soup, because maybe that's not how I experienced it. Maybe it was actually very particular and special. This is why I want to go back to the poem I opened with when you say, but now she's happy, incredulous in love. You don't want to translate this incredulity into accessible language that I can share with you, because part of it is it's not totally available to us.
Right.
So if poetry gives you the illusion, oh, it all can be rendered into language and anybody can share, I said, that's not what that experience was. So there's a certain sanctity to experience, or a certain preciousness or trauma, whatever word you want to use. If it's always translatable into what everybody can understand, that's maybe not capturing that then.
I think, is it Wallace Stevens who says, the poem must resist the intelligence almost successfully? But there is something, I think the poet Susan Howe has talked about poems coming out of a silence, you know, or poetry coming out of a silence. And that sense of the kind of sanctity of the uncommunicable, mm-hmm. is, I actually think Wordsworth, he talks about underpresences, and for all of his really elaborate discursive dilation on all kinds of things, I think there is a sense of the irreducible, and we all might have an experience of the irreducible, but we might not be able to fully communicate. We can index it, but we can't communicate it. And I do think, I have a, you know, clearly I have been a reader of Wordsworth in different keys for 25 years. And it's interesting to reread Wordsworth, you know, and it's like, you know, 25 years have passed, 25 summers with a length of 25 winters. But there's a sense, too, that, I have a kind of profound and ramifying ambivalence about Wordsworth. I feel like, in a way, why not? I feel that way about a lot of poets who have mattered a lot to me. I can be both repelled.
Yeah, you have a whole book. It's called My Poets, and it doesn't seem to be an ambivalent-free zone.
Yeah,
the other ones,
exactly.
You mean the other ones get sublimated into pleasure or
Wordsworth is sort of, there's a lot of superego in Wordsworth, and there's not a lot of it seems, you know. And I mean, if you want to talk about the ratios and again, it's not an accident that Keats diagnosed Wordsworth as sort of one afflicted with the egotistical sublime.
Because I read it first also, I don't know, 30 years ago, a long time ago, and I felt it was giving me hope that actually getting older is not such a despairing thing. That actually I thought, well, you know, you used to be so alive. And then, of course, we also know when you're young, you don't even know you're alive. All of that cliche. But I actually thought there was something kind of, and it didn't seem fake. It didn't seem he's selling me a bill of goods and saying, age and maturity and knowledge will give you abundant recompense. He actually thought, no, actually there's something else. You actually know the scope of experience. And it doesn't take, it changes. It's not the same. It's different, and it could be good in a different way. So I actually thought there was something kind of
That's
hopeful
really
that I, my ambivalence, I was kind of heartened by it and thought, and it's interesting when I reread Hartman, so the unremarkable Wordsworth and the first book, and then Bloom, and Bloom calls him a canonical poet, canonical memory in a chaotic age. We have no more orientations, and he says, but he gives us what we can remember. He is our Hermes, he's our guide to what we can remember. He said he establishes memory as a key in an age where there's no guidance. A really interesting kind of argument. And Bloom says, I misread Wordsworth when I was young, which Bloom says all the time because Bloom has been getting, you know. And so, but in some ways, I felt there was something heartening to say, oh, you getting older is not so terrible. You know?
I actually think this points to something, too, that that Wordsworth's writing is part of a kind of broader, what we might call a wisdom tradition. You know, I actually think it's part of a broader tradition, and one can feel coerced by that at times. One can also feel heartened by it. And I do think that he is a really tremendous poet of earned complexity. I do not think, at his best, I do not think he gives you, you know, shortcut consolations. I don't think, you know, and I find that very admirable, and also a kind of complex solace, right. You know. And part of it, too, is, well, it used to be uncontroversial that people went to poetry, you know, in Horatian terms, you know, to be delighted or instructed. And and a lot of times, you know, if as Keats said about Milton, we resist those things that have a palpable design on us. You know, if we feel we're being hectored, right, it's like, oh, no, but it's, you know, it's fine. You have the philosophic mind now that you're an adult, and you know how, you have proportion, and you know how to place these experiences. So that can feel like a kind of disciplinary, move. And at other times it can be companionable. I'm always just surprised when I reread Wordsworth because I have different reactions. Sometimes I feel, oh my God, now we're going to have another hymn to the wind, right? After we got to a very difficult moment in something about, you know, the mother's death, or, you know, a farmer displaced from his land. And you can feel like there is something, he's going to make a kind of Wordsworthian move that's going to be annoying. And on the other hand, so I feel, no, this is really, there is a kind of profundity here that is earned and can be companionable. So really it depends on, you know, my own mood. I mean, he had a book, he called a book of his, which is hysterical, Moods of My Own Mind, which I think is really, really funny. And also the seriousness of this, taking moods seriously, right, as a kind of fabulous, romantic, psychological, philosophical commitment. So I think he's interesting in that key as well.
But I like it as a kind of companion, that there's a kind of, there can be an ambivalence, but you say he's going through it with you.
Yeah.
It's a nice way. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to look for the hymn to the wind now after this. So I really want to thank you for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
I hope to have you back on for another one of your poets.
Well, you got a lot of little windows into some of them, but thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.